Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast. I'm Whitney Johnson. I'm an author, speaker, and write on the topic of disruption for LinkedIn and Harvard Business Review. I'm delighted to announce that this episode is brought to you by Harvard Business Review. Its weekly podcast, the HBR IdeaCast, features leading thinkers in business and management. In my book, Disrupt Yourself, I codified a framework for putting disruptive innovation to work. Because I can't get enough of these ideas, I'm continually looking for opportunities to explore them in greater depth. My guest is Naveen Rajdev. He's the Chief Marketing Officer for Wipro, a massive technology company you've never heard of, because they work behind the scenes. Take Chelsea Football Club of the English Premier League. Naveen and his colleagues recently reimagined the entire fan experience for this soccer team. Naveen actively seeks out ways to disrupt. As a young man, he got creative with crayons in his bedroom when he could have simply hung up a few posters. Now, when many are going digital, he's launched a print magazine. He's even diving into thinking creatively about how cities run better in the future.
My name is Naveen Rajdev, and I'm the Chief Marketing Officer of Wipro Limited.
Will you tell me, as if I were a 10-year-old, what exactly Wipro does?
Sure. You know, it's kind of interesting because sometimes I find it hard to explain it to my kids what we do. So from in simple terms, we take our clients' big technology problems and solve them both through disruptive and design way as well as operational way. So think of us from a perspective that, you know, we can help you come up with a new solution which can be solved using technology, or we can help you enter into a new market leveraging technology.
So give me a specific example.
Sure. and just to finish on that, and extend that globally as well. That's the. So I'll give you, there are plenty of examples. You know, when you look at it, we have a client who is a telecom company in Europe. In some countries, they are a telecom company. In some countries, they are a bank. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you... how a technology partner can come across and help them build a platform which can enable them to be a bank in some other organization. That's one simple example, you know, where, I mean, it sounds simple, but yeah, you try
so
to convert
So a telecom company in Europe that needs to act, function as a bank. In certain markets.
Market, yes.
Because people are going to text the money, et cetera.
Yeah, many ways, many different ways. I mean, it's multi-channel platform. You know, they're going to have kiosks, ATMs. Mm-hmm. You know, so whichever way, just bring everything together, integrate everything together. One of the sports clubs we are working with, Chelsea, you know, we talked about it in the media quite a bit about it, in terms of completely reimagining their fan experience, you know, and the way methodology works is we try to live the life of a fan in 24 hours, like, you know, that, okay, what it means to be a fan of Chelsea 24 hours before the game. So you imagine, you think more disruptive, you think more from a design standpoint, you help them go ahead and build that experience for the fan and then integrate. Mm-hmm. So imagining the experience, reimagining the experience, building it is the design aspect of it. But when you extend it globally and make it happen for, mm-hmm. They have 500 million followers on social media across the globe. And when you try to enable those platforms to that scale, yes, it
this
requires
is the This is Chelsea, the soccer team in
just,
UK.
Just a soccer team. UK,
okay,
yeah.
500 million.
Yeah, they're 500 million fans. So yeah, when you work with that, mm-hmm. Those kind of, at that scale, it becomes a very different thing to deal with.
How would you describe your role as a CMO? What does it involve to be a chief marketing officer?
In simple terms, the way I see my role as, that who is going to be buying our services and technology from us 2 years down the line? And every single day, I worry about that. So it's about forward positioning the company so that, you know, the customers, the people who are going to be our customers 2 years down the line, they see us as relevant. I worry about that. I mean, that is the fundamental point I have taken up. And the second point I look at it is our brand. We are a very, very iconic brand, both globally and as in India, and of course, many interests outside technology services, although I look at the technology business from a CMO standpoint. But yes, you have to really worry about the brand. And brand is like, you know, our war cry. You know, it's a war cry of 170,000 people in Wipro.
War cry.
Yeah.
Oh,
so how do I want to build that? What we stand for? How people every morning when they wake up and think about Wipro. Is what goes through my mind every single day. I've had times in the campus, you know, as I walk in, I see somebody carrying a very, you know, a different bag from a conference which has a competitor logo. I've had times when I have bought the bag for the person, a Wipro bag, and I said, no, you cannot. You know, it's not about competitor part, but I think, you know, understand what our war cry is. Mm-hmm. Do you understand who we are and what we stand for and what we do for our customers? And those are the fundamental things in very simple terms from my, you know, who is going to buy from us 2 years down the line and what is our war cry, and I'm able to, can I hold the war cry for 170,000 workforce we have.
When you said this to your son, what did he say?
He did not get the war cry part.
Maybe he needs to go climb a mango tree.
Yes. You know, but I think, I think everybody gets that part, that, you know, who you are in the future, who are you going to be relevant for? And I think that part, they get it. Over the last 21 months, I've been in this role. I think one thing which we have really driven inside the team is trend thinking. And not just our team, but, you know, across Wipro, that trend thinking, you know, who, what is going to be the next thing, but not 5 years down the line.
So trend thinking.
Yeah, trend thinking. Mm-hmm. What is going to be the trend 2 years from now? So worry about that so that you're always ahead of the customer, because, and then there's an intuitive math to, you know, 2 year period. You know, I don't want to be thinking so far out that, oh yeah, I'm going to use my iPhone to transplant my liver. But it is something, what is going to be more relevant for our customer, which technology. Oh, I see the growth of IoT sensors growing. So yeah, let's talk more about that. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure we have the service offering which caters to that.
And IoT is Internet of Things.
Internet
sensors.
Of Things, yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
You've just mentioned that one aspect of your job is to represent your company's brand, to
yes,
sound the war cry. How have you been able to be disruptive in this role?
You know, first of all, when I tell people that, you know, we need to be relevant for our customers or people who are going to be our customers 2 years down the line, I think that in itself doesn't, I mean, people take time to really think about, oh yeah, okay, I get it, what you're talking about. I took over this role, Whitney, at a point in time when I think I dealt with phenomenal amount of disruption. You know, our customers are completely getting disrupted. And I'll come to the point in terms of what we did to be disruptive. Our customers are getting disrupted. They are dizzy. They have, you know, many of the companies have no idea. 52% of the Fortune 500 companies are hardly making any profit. Our customers are completely dizzy in terms of, you know, oh, who's going to disrupt them? What is going to happen? When we look at our traditional services, technology services, business process services, they are getting fundamentally disrupted as the models are shifting more towards digital. We invested in four companies in the last 18 months. You know, we bought four companies, we made four acquisitions. We invested in eight other startups through our venture fund. I had a new CEO, you know, taking over. What more disruption anyone would want in their career span of 21 months. But the fundamental belief of that, let's be relevant. Let's try to improve, constantly improve our brand promise. So first thing which I took was trend thinking. That was quite disruptive. I don't think anyone agreed from that standpoint that, you know, is this what we need to do? But once everybody saw that what it could mean, how the whole organization could start to think more forward, I think that was one of the things which started to, you know, caught up. The second thing we did was we started to all wear jeans, my team, against the company dress code. But the idea was that, you know, if we are a technology brand, let's be a cool technology brand. Let's see if we can drive that. To almost a year and a half later, where our CEO announced that, okay, I think everybody should be walking into the jeans, into the company. So, yeah, we wear country club jeans, so not faded or anything like that. And because I need to be in a lot of formal meetings. But
so that's trend thinking. You set the trend.
Yes, we set the trend on that. The third thing we did was, which was really against everyone, I launched a magazine called Wool. And there was really no reason behind calling it Wool. You know, W stands for Wipro, L stands for Limited, Wipro Limited. Somewhere I, you know, wore that kind of a cognitive hat and thought about it, but we wanted to name it, let's build something cool. And behind that cool, it just became wool. I was drying my hands in a bathroom where a piece of wool was just flying out, you know, underneath. And the name came to my mind. Oh, yeah, let's name it Wool. And we named the magazine Wool. And it turned out to be, it's a trend magazine. Contrary to everyone's belief, we did not launch the digital version of it. Given the fact that we are the purveyors of digital, we are the ones who hold it. Because I read one of the trends that, you know, the physical book sales on Amazon, they were going up. And the second thing is the printing has become more precious. You know, we take 2,000 pictures in a month, but we print only two, those which are very... So why don't we work hard to make something very, very precious and print and give it to our customers, and you know, they're going to like it. And just make sure it is controlled in a way that who it goes to and what we feature in there. So taking complete liberty of the magazine, you know, to make it more independent. I got really beaten up on that. That
you know, did.
I did from very, very senior executive team. I mean, beaten up as in like in a good way. They had all the right to ask all the contrarian questions that, you know, I get so many magazines and we put them on the side and why would you print? And when I give them that statistic that the print precious is the trend we observe, today it is one of the things, the kind of people we have featured in the magazine, the way our customers are liking it, I think that was fundamentally very, very
disruptive. So the feedback
has been very, very positive. We are building that as a very, very strong property. Our entire competition stack is looking at us that what did they do? You know, the good part was that team started to think more disruptive. I think that was the most fundamental thing which I achieved behind that. Think more trends, think more disruptive, be ready to take risks, stand by it, have conviction of doing it.
So there was something meta going on here. So the magazine itself was almost became an emblem or a talisman of your focus on doing things differently, changing the status quo. And so it gave people a physical manifestation of that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And then many, many steps we took after that, you know, in terms of how we represent our brand, how we go after influencers, how we connect, you know, with our customers. There are a lot of things we are doing which are very different from which anyone can challenge that, oh, you know, for last, this is what we are used to doing. And how come you're not participating in this event, or how come you're not doing this? I'm like, no, we are not doing it because we can see forward. That we're, it's always about where the puck is going. And I think we got some pulse of it.
Okay. In many ways, it sounds like your job is really to be the embodiment of your brand, of the Vipro brand. How far does that responsibility extend into your life, into other aspects of your life?
Everywhere. You know, everywhere. If you talk to my kids, they'll tell you. Right now, what my 9-year-old is flipping through is Best American Infographics 2015. Maria Popova, she has some role in that, creating that book. As he's going through that, there's another book called Listomania. You know, which lists out all the cool facts, you know, around that. Does he need to really, you know, go through that? Probably not. I think this role has given, that's why my Twitter handle say love being the CMO of Wipro in the most disruptive, digitally disruptive times. I really love it. I'm really loving that part where I get to wake up in the morning, absorb disruption, and pass it on somewhere, which right from climbing that mango tree existed in me, that how I could disrupt, and then play around with different things. So it's way deeper. I mean, anyone I meet, you know, you will hear from them that, oh yeah, I mean, you know,
this is who Naveen
is. This is who I am, and you know, it's not conforming to the norms doesn't appear to be very normal. In fact, I'll give you one thing. In my college, the last year of college when I stayed at home, of course, day scholar as a day scholar, my entire room, I did not have posters on my room, but I took crayons and wrote graffiti and drew graffiti on my walls.
I
only have one picture surviving of that. Yes, right from the floor to top. Anyone, anyone who looked at my room, they said, if my kids would do it, we'll throw them out of the home. One, my parents were very tolerant about that. But I think even as of now, you know, I have not seen anyone do that. And it and I have great memories of that room, hand-drawn every single inch of the wall.
I would love it if you would send a copy of that photo and we could put it up with this.
I'll try to.
If you can find it.
Yeah.
That would be fantastic. I have all these imaginings about what it looks like. Why did you decide to draw that, graffiti on your wall?
So a little bit of a restlessness of, so here's one thing. Given a choice, I would have become a designer of some sorts or stayed with the creative field. I couldn't. I didn't work on that or whatever, whichever way. So I did not get any professional education. But that's the beauty of creativity. You can be creative in anything you do. So when the time came to, you know, I'm now in college and I need to express myself, you know, when everyone is putting up posters, you know what? Somewhere I drew something with a crayon on the wall and the texture looked just absolutely amazing. Then I went ahead and drew a small broken wall on it. And after that, cut it out, you know, whatever, one after the other. Yeah, I mean, until every single inch of the wall was with, had graffiti on it. I drew Fido, normal is boring, which was 7-Up emblem at that point in time. Yeah, I mean, a lot of stuff.
So here you were a physics major.
Yes.
And you're doing graffiti on your wall in your bedroom.
Yes.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah. And I can talk about theory of relativity with the same ease.
Yes. Okay. Cities.
Yes.
It's one of your passion projects. You're concerned that second-tier cities in the United States are becoming irrelevant. They're being disrupted. Will you talk about what that is, where that came from? Which cities you consider to be second-tier cities?
Yeah, I mean, you know, over the last many, many years, that is becoming my more and more pet side thought and becoming more and more mainstream. And, you know, I think I looked at it in multiple ways. One, we all have seen, you know, how the manufacturing has become very, very global. Technology services has become global. And then I saw that, you know, how cities in some states or in some countries, they are commanding the major share of GDP. I mean, more than 50% in some countries. And then you look at our American cities, like, you know, I live in Atlanta, or you look at Kansas City and they're Cleveland. And a ton of American cities when you look at Pittsburgh, sadly enough, people call them, you know, now part of the Rust Belt and all that stuff. But when you look at it, there was a point in time there was some great talent. Mm-hmm. These cities thrived because of the great talent. And these cities thrived because they kind of concentrated some sort of talent one way or the other. And that gave city some kind of a brand name. You know, when Detroit was called Motown or Paris, City of Light. I mean, you know, City of Light. What's wrong? You know, everything starts to look exactly similar. And the talent starts to, you know, they go to high school in one city or they go to the college and all of a sudden you see a flight, into another, you know, wherever they can find. And the major towns are really concentrating a lot of talent, which is not bad, but it puts a lot of pressure on them. Mm-hmm. And you start to see these cities, you know, what we saw at the time of Rust Belt in this digital era. You know, this could happen much faster. Mm-hmm. So unless some cities start to create some programs where citizens take pride in it, I mean, the good part about digital is you can work from anywhere. You can design a studio, you can put up a studio anywhere. I mean, we ourselves have a lot of studios. We ourselves have development centers in different cities of the world. So it just struck me that, you know, are we doing enough in these mm-hmm. cities? Or are we going to see, you know, another sort of a Rust Belt or mm-hmm. I don't know what the metaphor for the silicon or
well,
whatever,
think,
you know.
I think the Rust Belt works.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you know, that's where it started that, you know, but in another 15, 20 years, you know, there are going to be, the world is going to be, majority of the GDP is going to come from 65 odd cities. And I want my city if some citizens really get up and say, you know, I want my city to be part of that 65, I think there's going to be good competition. There are going to be good trade deals. You know, why the trade deals between the country? Why not between the cities? I mean, what's wrong with it, right? How some brands can be attracted into those cities so that the, you know, talent can start to concentrate. And, I mean, there was a point in time when Murano, Italy was famous for glass. Now it's get done. So why can't we go out and create another Murano?
Where did this come from? You said your wife is the controller for the city of Atlanta. And it's interesting because if your company does its job well, it accelerates the disruption, potentially, of these small cities. So those are two potential reasons why this could matter to you. But there's something very deep, and I'm wondering what it is.
I think when I look at kids... not just my kids, but you know, in general, I definitely think from that perspective that what will be the opportunities for them, there was a many years I wanted to move to New Jersey. I was part of KPMG, and I asked my boss that his name was Jules. I'm like, Jules, can I move to New Jersey? He's like, yeah, no problem. I mean, I was living in Chicago, and I was traveling. I said, it could bring it down. But then he called me into his room and says, close the door. He says, is this the place you want your kids to grow? And I'm like, I don't know. He says, no, you want to think about that. Is this the community, the kind of exposure? If this is the place, then definitely move. I did not move to New Jersey. I continued to live in Chicago, and we moved to Atlanta. But I think that's where there is some deep-seated thought from those 15 years back, which is in my mind, that are we... there was a place we chose to live. Can we, if my kids start to feel, or anyone start, no, I want to live in Atlanta. I want to live in, I have my family here, extended family here. But I just see jobs evaporating. I think cities can start to stand up and create those opportunities. Why not? I think that's the obligation of every citizen of that city, to really feel pride. I mean, don't we take pride in our teams, football teams? So what's wrong with taking pride? I mean, I may live in New York, but I'll still wear Falcons jersey because I take so much pride. So why can't I do the same thing when I'm in Atlanta, right? I mean, or do something for it.
All right, so let's put your CMO hat on. Let's say you're sitting down with the mayor of Cleveland. What's one or two things they can do, or he or she can do, in order to not get disrupted?
Sure. One, really identify, there are two things which go hand in hand. The biggest driver becomes the education, in terms of what your school system is, what you're teaching, how they are building the school. Are they looking forward as a city? What is their vision of the city 10 years from now, 15 years from now? Then there are certain elements you start to really pull up from the city and say, I think this is one area where we can start to concentrate talent. We can really go out, reach out to companies and tell them that, we really have this kind of talent. Come and work with us and we'll make it happen. So education becomes one of the fundamental things. They need to be thinking forward. That's why trend thinking is very important. From my company standpoint, right now I might be thinking 3, but then somebody has to think 5, somebody has to think 15, because when you're looking at changing the school system or working through the curriculums, it does take time. One from that, pick up the best aspects of the citizenry, build the pride. Build the pride in citizenry. Go, let them go out, invite the companies. We always talk about that, here is a startup, in my community which is coming out, and rightly so, when it comes to Internet of Things and a lot of this stuff, there is going to be a lot of DIY stuff which will come out from garages. There's a lot of potential out there. But when you look at fundamentally these things, from the city standpoint, as they start to build up, they can reach out to these bigger companies and say, guys, come over. Hey Google, hey Facebook, hey Wipro, come to my city. This is what I have to offer you. Your next digital pod, you've created one in London, you've created one in San Francisco. Yeah. Because for us, again, talent is more important. We promise you. Here are my universities. We will work with you to build that talent. We will ensure that the talent stays, right? Whitney, look at it this way. No client would give me work if I take up a project and, you know, deal with the attrition and the people are leaving the project. I mean, they give us because they fundamentally believe that we can accomplish.
Right.
So when I look at, you know, investing in a city as a company to build my next digital pod, talent becomes the most important thing.
Right. So education that drives talent. And then what is the distinctive strength of that city? Talent that's in this city that may not be anywhere else.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you look at it, you know, Atlanta was promoting itself. Oh, you know, after Hollywood, we are the next production, big production house. You know, a lot of movies. I mean, Hidden Figures was shot in Atlanta, and there are many other famous movies. But, you know, there was a small thing which many people actually ignored. When you look at the payment processing, First Data, NCR, Elavon, you know, global payments, they all have concentrated their headquarters in Atlanta.
Interesting.
I mean,
so it's
why don't we continue to bring more companies in then and start to concentrate talent in that?
Interesting.
Yeah.
How do you think about risk?
I see risk more as a disruption element. Mm. I think I don't see risk as an operational element. Containing risk is an operational element, but I see today it's more disruption risk. Which comes
risk that you will an entity or person will be disrupted.
Yes. So you need to really work from that paranoia.
I mean,
it's not the fear as much, you know, as I may be, you know, but it is, I think, the opportunity.
And awareness, yeah.
And awareness, yeah.
Okay. All right. What will you do to disrupt yourself in 2017?
I think if I can do something for the cities, if I can... So, Whitney, when I met you and, you know, since the time I've been pursuing it. So I'm really meeting a lot of influential people in the cities. If I can get that voice out, I'm not looking at anything from that commercial standpoint. But generally, I mean, if it can really help some cities to really put that plan in place, I will feel disrupted. You know, because the whole citizenry of the city will disrupt themselves. And, you know, in a large system, it becomes a very, very tough task, you know, when you look at it.
So you will evangelize and continue to reach out to people and have those conversations.
Every single day. I don't shy away. In fact, I'm meeting some of influential people in the city of New York in this month. I met a lot of people in Atlanta and many other cities. So we'll continue on that journey.
Terrific. Yeah. So we will follow up with you in
Absolutely.
6 to 9 months' time and see how it's going.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Naveen, thank you so much for taking this time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me, Whitney. It was amazing. Yeah.
When I heard Naveen speak at Constellations Conference about his vision for cities, I knew I wanted to interview him. I frequently think about the competitiveness of countries and companies and their distinctive strengths, but I've never sliced the world into cities. What does your city do well that other cities don't? What is it known for? And rather than trying to craft a narrative or even make it up, how do you extract the story that's already there? A conversation with Naveen made me think of one I'd had with John Maeda, former president of the Rhode Island School of Design. John said that when you're trying to make a change inside of an organization, if you'll study back to what happened from the beginning, you reclaim your power from people who say, that's not how we do it here. Knowing history gives you power to change an organization, a city, to change yourself. For a list of people, places, publications mentioned in this podcast, there are links in the show notes at whitneyjohnson.com. If you'd like a transcript of this interview, it's available to our newsletter subscribers. And if you enjoy the Disrupt Yourself podcast, leave us a review on iTunes. Thank you to Naveen Rajdev for being our guest, to producer David Klatt, sound engineer Jay Yao, editor Heather Hunt, show notes contributor Macy Robison, and art director Brandon Jameson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.